and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the surprise upset victory in Tuesday's New York primary election by 28-year-old Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who defeated the fourth most powerful Democrat in the House and will be the youngest member ever to serve in the United States Congress. A Democratic socialist and a protege of Senator Bernie Sanders, Alexandria was the first candidate recruited to run in this year's primary by Justice Democrats. And the co-director of Justice Democrats, Corbin Trent, joins us to discuss how his grassroots organization is running 38 congressional candidates who are committed to refusing PAC money and who will fight for progressive change. We'll discuss the importance of authenticity and genuine connections to constituents and how Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and other candidates, Justice Democrats hope to get elected to Congress, will not accept the limited horizons of tinkering with Washington at the margins and the need to go along with the system, which is only capable of accepting small incremental change, rather than change the entire system to serve the people, not the donor class. Then we'll speak with Stephanie Kelton, Professor of Economics and Public Policy at Stony Brook University, New York, who served as Chief Economist on the United States Senate Banking Committee and as Economic Advisor to Bernie Sanders' 2016 presidential campaign. The author of the forthcoming book, The Deficit Myth, she joins us to discuss the recent report by the Congressional Budget Office warning that Trump's tax cuts for the wealthy and corporations will add close to $2 trillion more to the federal deficit over the next 10 years, adding to the $21 trillion national debt, which candidate Trump, citing his brilliant business record, promised he would use to get rid of the debt over a period of 8 years. Then finally, we will examine the record of retiring Supreme Court Justice Kennedy, who is being widely praised as a swing vote who sided with the liberal minority on important issues. Lisa Graves, co-director of Documented, a watchdog group that investigates how corporations manipulate public policy, harming our environment, communities, and democracy, joins us. She served as chief counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and we will discuss how a president who is under investigation for possible criminal activity and even treason should not be able to stack the highest court in the land with judges who could exonerate him. And joining us now is Corbin Trent, the founder of Tennessee for Bernie Sanders and the co-director of Justice Democrats, a progressive political action committee running 38 congressional candidates who are committed to refusing corporate PAC money and who will fight for progressive change. Welcome to Background Briefing, Corbin Trent.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And Corbin, I was watching Chris Hayes on MSNBC last night. He was interviewing Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who just won in a surprise upset in New York against the fourth most powerful Democrat in the House. And she was absolutely brilliant, I thought, in the interview with him. But she was asked, you know, how did you decide to run? And she said, well, I got recruited by Justice Democrats. So I guess you can take a bow, right, for recruiting her.
Yeah, absolutely. It was, you know, we're proud to be part of that process that led to her, you know, her victory on Tuesday. We're proud to have been supportive of her in any way possible. And, you know, I guess we can take a small amount of credit in helping her get started and in helping her along the way. We were there in the beginning and there in the end, but the entire middle, the thing that really built the foundations of what led to her victory was her and her volunteers and supporters and all the people on the ground here in the district.
So then let's extrapolate it out. You're running candidates in 38 congressional races, is that right?
Yeah, there's right now I think we've got another 31 to go, right? So overall we're going to have endorsed 72 candidates this cycle. And we've got, I think the number is 16 that are now the nominee that are going to head to the general. And then we've got, I believe the number's 31 races remaining to go. So we've got, you know, Florida, Missouri, Kansas, you know, we've got several more to go. So Rhode Island Governor, Ayanna Pressley, we've got James Thompson, Brent Welder, Charter Richardson in Florida 70 going up against the Blue Dog Democrat, Stephanie Murphy. So, yeah.
So, obviously, since you were the founder of Tennessee for Bernie Sanders, you have connections to the Sanders campaign, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who just got the Democrat nomination for that mm-hmm. House seat, which is a pretty safe Democratic seat. So we can assume that she'll be the youngest U.S. congressperson in the history of this country as of next January.
Right.
Can you describe the platform in general? If you're recruiting people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, what are you looking for?
Well, so we were looking for a few things. We came out, there were a handful of us that were working on the national staff at the Sanders campaign. And just before the California primary back in 2016, we thought, win or lose, doesn't matter what happens with this, this primary right now. And, we need a Congress that's going to help Bernie if he wins. And if it's not, we need a Congress that's going to fight the good fight. So we went, the next thing we started was a brand new Congress. We did that for a while, but that idea, for at least for me, made way more sense if we had a Hillary Clinton incumbent, win the presidency. We ultimately, of course, ended up with Trump, and I think that that's the reason we went with Justice Democrats, because the real key here is making sure that the Democratic Party is a party that's going to be capable of representing the needs and the will of the American people, so that we don't end up with more Republican wins. I mean, we've seen decade-long upset after upset from the Republican Party, that we've lost 1,000 seats nationally. And so that was why we moved over there. And what we looked for in the candidates, from along the journey there, was people that, that had experienced what it was like to live in the district they were trying to run, that had really deep ties, deep roots to the district, people from working class backgrounds in most cases. And people, one of the other things that we looked for, and this is going to be, this maybe sound a little odd, but we looked for people that had had opportunities to sell out, an opportunity to sort of get ahead by stepping on other people and didn't take it, right? Because we feel like it doesn't matter how good a person is, or how politically savvy they are, or how good their politics are. Once you're in Washington, there's forces there. There's a political gravity to pull you in. Right. And make you into this sort of defeated, go along, go with the flow. You can't fight the machine. It is what it is. That pressure that's going to try to collapse you into being just like any other incumbent is so great that we feel like you got to find sort of these little people that are already diamonds that can stand up to that kind of pressure. And so we're looking for examples of when they've done that before.
And again, I'm speaking with Corbin Trent, the founder of Tennessee for Bernie Sanders and the co-director of Justice Democrats, a progressive political action committee running 38 congressional candidates who are committed to refusing corporate PAC money and who will fight for progressive change. Nancy Pelosi was asked about the victory of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and she more or less said, well, it's about the seat. It's about the neighborhood.
And
it's about what?
Nothing indicative of anything wider than that. Keeps saying that. That's what we keep hearing from the leadership of this party.
Right.
Bernie filling stadiums with 30,000 people. Nothing's going on here, folks. Nothing to see. Nothing's happening. There's no movement. The leadership of the Democratic Party continues to keep their head in the sand on this, right? And that's the reason we've got a Trump presidency. That's the reason we're just going to, we're going to have a Supreme Court stacked. With ideological, ideologues, right? And the reason for that is because the Democratic Party's leadership had its head in the sand and believes that nothing's happening, right? They want to think, we can just do business as usual. We don't have to, start really working to make sure that we're trying to make people's lives better. And I think, what they're going to see is that if they won't change and they can't actually start working for the people of this nation and making sure that they're trying to, trying to improve their lives, then the only way forward is to replace them.
So, but what kind of candidates would you run then in red states that you're trying to swing to purple or blue?
Mm-hmm.
Because, as you know, in those earliest races, say in Pennsylvania, they ran a pretty conservative Democrat, but he did win. Would a more liberal candidate have won along the...
I think, I don't really... Liberal, progressive, conservative, I don't know. I think that a genuine, authentic candidate that is, running on a platform that is going to make people's lives better, whether it's, you know, Medicare for all, whether it's, you know, $15 an hour living wage that's tied to inflation, if it's, you know, if it's college tuition that's federally funded and tuition free in the state and community colleges, you know, that sort of thing I think is going to resonate with people. We can say, okay, well, that's a liberal agenda, or that's this or that's that. But I think, you know, more than that, it's a way to get this country back on track. It's a way to get our economy and our society back on track. And yeah, I think that's what's going to resonate with voters. Also, if they believe what you're saying, you know, Bernie Sanders, I'm from Northeast Tennessee, and it's a really Republican area, really Republican. And I was talking to, you know, some old guys and folks that live in the area there. And back in the 2016 cycle, what they were telling me is, I'm voting for Trump or I'm voting for Bernie. You know, they believe Bernie. Now, they said he was a socialist. They didn't vote. They did not agree with his politics. Do not get me wrong, right? But they trusted that when he said something, he said it because he believed it and because he meant it, right? And I think that goes a long way with people. You know, you can't have people that are talking and you feel like they're lying to you.
So what would you then, how would you address the criticism from Steve Schmidt, the Republican who ran the McCain campaign and has now left the Republican Party because of Trump? On MSNBC yesterday, yeah, he was asked about the upset in New York by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and he warned about what he described as dishonest progressivism, saying that if candidates like Alexandria and Cory Booker and others on the progressive Democratic side promise all of these free education and health care, et cetera, et cetera, he's described that as dishonest progressivism in the sense that they have got to say how you're going to pay for it. And to some extent, that was manifested here in California. The state government here had a Medicare for All single-payer bill which didn't pass because the voters didn't feel that there was enough transparency about how to pay for it. So is that, well, let me have you address Steve Schmidt's notion of dishonest progressivism.
So yeah, I think if people like Steve Schmidt had been running this country back in the 40s and 50s and 60s, what, you know, we wouldn't have had a space program that got us to the moon. We'd have had one that fell flat in the ocean and time after time. We wouldn't have had a buildup of our industrial resources that defeated the Nazis in World War II. We wouldn't have had satellites in space. You know, it's people that have no vision, that can't dream big, that can't look forward to a better, brighter, you know, future, that are going to damn us to a bad, to a, right? That's the problem with people like Steve Schmidt. They've got no vision, right? And thank goodness there's other people out there like Alexandria Ocasio and others that have that vision for a bigger and a better future for all Americans. We're the richest nation in the history of the world, right? And I tell you one thing, you mentioned California. One thing California doesn't have, they're the, you know, sixth largest economy in the world, if they were their country, et cetera, et cetera. One thing they don't have is the ability to print money. We have the world reserve currency. The United States has the world reserve currency. We are the most powerful nation on the planet. We're the richest nation in the history of the world. And if we can't build something to make the lives of its citizens better, then there's no hope for anybody ever doing it anywhere, right? You know, you want to hear about, oh, there's not as many people in Scandinavia, or there's not as many people here. You know, they've got these, you know, there's always a reason why we can't do something in America that's being done all over the world, right? But, you know, somehow China figures out how to give health care to its people. Somehow Cuba's got a 98% literacy rate. Somehow the UK has health care for its citizens. Somehow every other, you know, advanced nation on the planet has figured out how to, you know, do its best to get citizens health care, to create high wage jobs, and to go forward and build a better country for themselves, right? And I think to sell America short and think that we can't do it is just foolish, and it doesn't give the American people the respect they deserve.
Well, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, of course, was asked that same question about Steve Schmidt and, yeah, you know, how do you pay for it? And she said, which I think no other Democrat seems to have the courage to say, you raise taxes on the rich. You know, I mean, you know, Eisenhower's time, the rich were paying 92%. I mean, it's not exactly rocket science, is it?
No, I don't think it is. I think there's, you know, there's people that are able to take more and benefit more from a society. It's sort of like, you know, this is a very small piece of the puzzle, but for, you know, when we look at our roads, right? A lot of times our roads are paid for various ways by the states. But, you know, the people that really utilize the roads most are trucking companies, right? So who should be maintaining our roads, right? Probably the people that make money hand over fist off of it, right? So, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. That's absolutely the path to that. And, you know, nobody says, you know, how are we going to pay for this war, right? Nobody says that. You know, how are we going to pay for police? How are we going to pay for all these things we pay for? How do we pay for libraries? How do we pay for roads? How do we pay for bridges? How do we pay for, you know, the things that are falling apart in this country? Is A, we raise taxes on the rich, but also B, we just, you know, we start actually spending a little bit more money. We're willing to run. We're willing to, you know, to put money into things that destroy people's lives and kill people. We ought to be able to put money into stuff that makes their lives better, too.
Well, just in closing, Corbyn, since the working Americans and middle-class Americans have not had a raise in 40 years, 40% of working Americans are a $400 emergency away from being on the street and destitute. Many of those people voted for Donald Trump. You were just saying earlier that you talked to Trump voters in northern Tennessee. How can Democrats reach out to these angry former Democratic voters who feel betrayed by their party and who drank the Trump Kool-Aid? Clearly, he is taking care of the plutocrats and stiffing the working guy. Uh-huh. So how do you think your organization and your candidates can basically win over those very angry people who are, I think, quite rightly disgusted with politics as usual, but unfortunately, they got taken in by a con man?
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, you mentioned that they don't have $400 in savings. 40% of Americans also made $19,000 or less. You know, so yes, there is a huge problem. I will say, I'll push back a tiny bit here. The, you know, the at least what I've read. For the Trump election, a lot of that actually, you know, a lot of his voters were also doing pretty well. You know, they were making 50, 60, 70,000 a year plus. But anyway, the, you know, your point's still very valid. And I think the way you do it is you recruit good, solid, trustworthy, honest candidates. And when you can, you find spokespeople like Alexandria Ocasio that can sort of bully the rest of the, you know, the rest of the group and the rest of the candidates and become an anchor and a mouthpiece for them. I think you ensure that you have a platform that's going to really get people inspired and excited. That's going to create, you know, change in people's lives and connect them back to their government, hopefully. And the third way is you make sure that your donors are not big, you know, big corporations, big lobbyist groups, you know, bundled money. And you make sure that you're funded by small dollar contributions. So, you know, that's what we've done. We've worked to recruit great candidates. We've worked at a great, you know, develop a great platform. And we've made sure that we've not taken, you know, big corporate cash and none of that. We're small dollar funded, just like every one of our candidates.
Well, Corbyn Trent, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. Have a good day.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Corbyn Trent, who's the founder of Tennessee for Bernie Sanders and the co-director of Justice Democrats, a progressive political action committee running 38 congressional candidates who are committed to refusing corporate PAC money and who will fight for progressive change. And the first candidate that they backed, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, just won in a surprise upset in New York's 14th congressional district. We're going to take a brief station break and back speaking with the former chief economist on the U.S. Senate Banking Committee, who was the chief economic advisor to Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign, about the CBO's dire warning about ballooning deficits.
We want the power for the people. That's all we ask in our country, dear. The sick and the hungry are unable. Protect them and those who may live in fear.
Well, my funds are gone and the banks is nigh. I beg in the places where I used to be. And I'm crazy.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Stephanie Kelton, Professor of Public Policy and Economics at Stony Brook University in New York. She served as Chief Economist on the U.S. Senate Budget Committee, and in 2015, she became an economic advisor to the Bernie Sanders 2016 presidential campaign. She's the author of The State, The Market, and the Euro, and her forthcoming book is The Deficit Myth. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephanie Kelton.
Thanks for having me back.
And in terms of the deficit myth, the opposite message is coming from the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office. They say that the longstanding financial outlook of the United States is very grim. They project soaring deficits in the coming years, with the debt ultimately peaking at more than 152% of the nation's gross domestic product. So we've heard about, whenever Republicans are in power, they always say the sky is falling because of deficits. And then when they get into power, they ignore deficits and run up the debt and the deficit. But now, with the CBO being independent, what do you make of that in terms of your forthcoming book in particular, The Deficit Myth? This seems like a deficit, what can I say, looming.
Well, it's the perpetual deficit bogey is what it is. It never ends. You know, we had a brief period of time when President Clinton was in office in the late 90s and early part of the 2000s, when the budget swung from its normal state, which is being in deficit, into a surplus. And it was at that time that the Congressional Budget Office that you're referring to was issuing reports that were projecting surpluses as far as the eye can see. So now you can see what a kind of difficult position that this puts the CBO in with its current projections, where they're saying, oh, my God, budget deficits as far as the eye can see, $1 trillion and so forth. And it creates lots of hysteria. And, you know, you're seeing that now, in fact, on both sides of the political aisle. But there was a time not so long ago when CBO was telling us exactly the opposite was going to happen, that we were going to be flooded with black ink as far as the eye can see. And, of course, that didn't happen. And what the Congressional Budget Office normally does, decade after decade after decade, is warn of looming fiscal crisis because of budget deficits and the accumulation of debt, the national debt growing over time. This never changes, with the exception, as I said, of that brief period when we had surpluses. They warn of potential crisis. This is a normal state of affairs at the Congressional Budget Office. And darn if things just never quite unfold the way CBO predicts that they will.
So would you say then that their projection, the CBO's projection, that the Republican tax law passed last fall will add $1.84 trillion to the federal deficit over the next 10 years?
Well, the truth is no one knows exactly what's going to happen to budget outcomes over the next 10 years. It's largely a reflection of what's happening in our economy. So, you know, you look back at what happened in 2008, 2009, 2010, you know, where the economy goes into the worst downturn since the Great Depression, budget deficits explode. And that happens quite automatically because of the state of the economy. A very weak economy means that when people are losing their jobs and their income is collapsing to zero, they aren't paying federal income taxes, while at the same time, they're drawing on a number of government programs that are there, you know, ready to kick into effect automatically when the economy gets weak, like unemployment compensation and food stamps and Medicaid and a whole host of other programs to support people when their incomes decline. So budget deficits automatically go up. No one knows what the economy is going to look like 2 years, 5 years, much less 10 years or more from now. If we get another recession, we're going to have big deficits going forward. But if we end up having stronger growth, a period of stronger growth, deficits naturally come down. So the first point is nobody really knows. CBO is making a forecast. But the more important point, I think, to make is that there's nothing necessarily inherently wrong with a $1 trillion budget deficit, even for many years in a row. That's not necessarily a bad thing for the economy.
Well, it's certainly not bothering America's investors, surely. I mean,
no, it's not. And you're right. And it doesn't bother Republicans, as you pointed out earlier. The Republicans are very good at staying laser focused on their agenda. They have the House, they have the Senate, they have the White House. They know exactly what it is they want to accomplish while they have this kind of power. And that is, they want to deregulate markets. You saw this with, you know, Wall Street, the, you know, beginning of the unwinding of Dodd-Frank. You're going to see lots of deregulation. And you're seeing the tax cuts being pushed through, corporate income tax, personal income tax, state tax, and so forth. And so tax cuts, deregulate, they're laser focused on this agenda, and they couldn't care less what happens to the budget deficit as a consequence. It is merely the means to an end. The budget is the means to an end. They don't care whether it produces deficits or bigger deficits going forward. What they care about is passing an agenda that serves the donor class. Let's be honest.
But nevertheless, Ronald Reagan sort of showed a pattern that Republicans engage in, and that is that they run up the defense budget enormously to foreclose discretionary spending, particularly on social programs, and then say the sky is falling, we've got to cut Medicare and Social Security. And meanwhile, of course, the servicing of the debt becomes a huge budget item, which is what the CBO report is warning about. That is something in the broader sense you can't ignore, surely, Stephanie, because who wants to spend all of your treasure on the Defense Department? Trump has run it up now to $716 billion for 2019. And the idea that America's creditors will get the second part of the lion's share, I guess the people who hold the debt, as I know, it's mostly the Chinese government. So surely that's something to avoid. I mean, if we're going to spending all of our treasure on defense and debt servicing, then there's not a prayer for doing all of the kind of things that Bernie Sanders is calling for and progressive Democrats are calling for.
So let's imagine that the situation is exactly the reverse of what we have today, that the Democrats control the House, the Senate, and the White House. What would prevent the Democrats from sitting down and putting numbers on a budget and saying, we're going to spend this much on infrastructure, we're going to spend this much on education, we're going to allocate this much to innovation, research, development, right? The kind of stuff that boosts long-term economic growth and prosperity. We're going to make sure that Medicare, we're going to have single payer or Medicare for all. We're going to make public colleges. We're going to Why, you know, you write it down. This is what we're going to do in all of these line items. And Congress passes the budget. Now, what stands in the way of achieving all of those things independent of what previous administration and previous Congress has done? Who cares what Congress did in 2018, in 2012, in 2011? That's all irrelevant. It's a new game. It's a blank slate. Okay. Yes, there are commitments that are locked in terms, as you say, of the interest payments. So that's okay. That's a line item on the budget, and there's a certain amount. I mean, I'm saying that's okay in the sense that it doesn't prevent Congress from spending more in other budget areas. And the language you used is interesting because twice you said treasure, spending all of our treasure. And I would point out that this is part of, I think, what the problem is with so much of the way that we talk about the federal government budget. It's as if there is a finite booty, like we're pirates, you know? There's a treasure and a treasure chest, and there's so much gold coin inside that chest, and we're literally dealing with a finite amount of money that's available to fund various priorities and programs. And if we spend this much on defense and we spend this much on interest on the national debt, then there's no money left to do anything else. And that's just not the way it works. So I would encourage people to step out of that gold standard kind of framing and recognize that in the modern era, Congress can fund whatever it chooses to fund. There is no financial constraint. There's no money constraint. The constraints that Congress faces are, you know, in the real economy. If you want to do trillions of dollars of infrastructure and you want to do health care and you want to do this and you want to do that, the question is, do you have the contractors, the engineers, the architects, the steel, the concrete, the machines? Do you have the doctors and nurses that... do you have the real resources to achieve those budget priorities should you choose to pursue them? It's not about the money, okay? We get so used to asking Congress, well, where are you going to find the money? Where are you going to find the money? What the Republicans have shown us is that that's not the relevant question. The question is, can you find the votes? And if you can find the votes, you can fund whatever it is that you want on your agenda.
So, therefore, to find the votes, then the Democrats should be enunciating priorities. And my understanding is that you do have to have revenues coming in, and by cutting the taxes of the wealthy, you're denying those revenues. And if you look back at the halcyon days of Dwight David Eisenhower, the rich were taxed at 92%, and lately it keeps going down and down. So to some extent, in my sort of naive understanding of budgets, that our tax structure is a kind of moral statement of our political DNA. So my suggestion would be that we've got to enunciate the vision and then come up with the plan and implement it, get the votes. But also, I mean, the fact that we're the only reserve currency and all the money is pouring in from overseas investors obviously puts a lie to the whole idea that the sky is falling. So we have enormous advantages. But I guess at the end of the day, it comes down to political priorities, and the Republicans are making it clear what their priorities are, but the Democrats aren't, as far as I can tell.
Well, I agree with that for sure. The Democrats take their eye off the ball. They get distracted. They allow things like, you know, the effect on the budget to override other priorities. So that's a problem. But, you know, when you say the budget is a moral document and so forth, that's true. The piece that I want to try to get us to move away from is this tendency to think of the federal government's budget like a household budget. So when you say, you know, the way that I understand budgets, you know, I'll often say to people, the problem we have so often is that the budgets that we're most familiar with, the finances we best understand, are our own. And because we know that we, in our individual capacities, can't go on spending more than we take in, that we have to live within our means, that we can't, you know, accumulate debt and not run into problems somewhere down the road, we then extrapolate from our personal experience to the federal government. We say, well, the same rules must apply. And the simple fact of the matter is the same rules don't apply. And the fundamental difference between them and us is that they issue the U.S. dollar and we simply use it. Look, if you had a patent on the U.S. dollar, would you ever worry that you're going to have bills you couldn't pay? Would you worry that you need China to manufacture dollars for you? The truth is the U.S. dollar, the currency, comes from the U.S. government, and it can't come from anywhere else. It doesn't come from China. The government doesn't get it from taxpayers. They don't need our money in order to fund projects and so forth. That should be evident because they've run deficits virtually the entire existence of the United States of America. So we just simply have it backwards. We need their money. They don't need our money. And we're not dependent on China. They're never going to run into a situation where the government goes broke, like a household or a private business. They're not going to end up like Greece. Greece ended up in trouble because Greece gave up their currency, the drachma, and started borrowing in a currency that they don't issue, the euro. So it's really important to get that piece right from the beginning, and then I think a whole lot of other space opens up where you can begin to see why the federal government is so different from a household, why it plays by a different set of rules, and like you said, good reasons to tax the wealthy. Absolutely, inequality at the degree that it, where we are in the U.S. today, like 1920s level of income and wealth inequality, very damaging both to the performance of the overall economy and to our democracy. So you can make a very strong case for increasing tax rates. You mentioned Eisenhower to, you know, marginal tax rates at the top to something much higher than where they are today. Not because you think you need the wealthy to pay for a variety of programs, but because you think they have too damn much money.
Well, the working Americans and middle-class Americans have not had a raise for 40 years. 40% of the country is a $400 emergency payment away from being destitute and being on the street. And many of those people, I think, voted for Trump. So when you've got the former Republican who just gave up in disgust, Steve Schmidt, who's on MSNBC quite a lot, saying that while he celebrates the election of the surprise upset in New York, with the young woman who is a Democratic
Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Exactly. And she is a protege of Bernie Sanders. And people are extremely excited about it. We talked to the person who recruited her on today's program. So how do you respond to Steve Schmidt's warning that she and Cory Booker and other progressive Democrats represent what Schmidt calls dishonest progressivism, where they promise a lot of free stuff, but they don't tell you how to pay for it?
Yeah, well, I could tell you how I would respond, but I'd rather tell you how she responded, because she was asked this very question, and I thought her response was quite on point. She used the phrase the public purse. Now, how many times have you heard a member of Congress invoke the public purse? And I suspect it's not very many, but she did. And one of the reasons she did is because she understands that the federal government is not like a household, that the U.S. dollar doesn't come from China, and that the federal government has this thing called the power of the purse. In other words, that they can do what we said earlier, what I mentioned, write a budget, and then authorize the various agencies to go out and start spending. The budgetary authorization is the pay for. That's where the money comes from. And she understands that, which is why she answered the question the way she did when they said, don't you have to go out and raise taxes on the rich in order to do all of these things? And she said, well, yeah, you should raise taxes on the rich, but you don't have to do that in order to fund everything. You have the power of the purse. So one way or another, she defended, she said, I defend the ability of the government to do the kinds of things that I'm talking about. It's not pie in the sky. It's not unaffordable. Okay, we can do these things because we have the power of the purse. And I thought it was terrific.
Well, from her lips to God's ears. I mean, do you think the rest of the party, just in closing, are going to take the cues from her? Because, you know, it's so obvious that...
Well, if they don't, I'll tell you what I worry about if they don't. What I worry about if they don't, if they stay in this frame where the only things you can do are small ball items, you can only tinker around the edges. You can't do big. You can't do bold. You can't do progressive. Why? Because everything has to be deficit neutral. And everything has to be, quote unquote, paid for. And if you operate in that budgetary frame, you will never put forward the kind of agenda that she put forward that won. What did she get? 54, 57% of the vote. I mean, she didn't just eke out a win. She absolutely clobbered the fourth most powerful Democrat in the House. And she did it by going big and going bold. And you can't do that if you're trapped in this budget frame where everything has to be deficit neutral. And because she doesn't carry that that economic baggage, she understands, I think she's in a position to advocate a much more ambitious kind of agenda. And I think clearly it worked. And hopefully others will look at what she did and pay attention to the messaging and, begin to change a little bit, because it isn't going to work. I think for the Democrats to offer a weak tea agenda, claiming that this is all very fiscally responsible, so therefore, you know, vote for me and not Donald Trump. I don't think voters are going to be engaged and excited by a small agenda that's quote unquote fiscally responsible.
Well, Stephanie Kelton, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I feel like
you're very welcome.
I feel like I've been educated and inspired, and I thank you.
Thanks, Ian. Great to be with you.
And again, I've been speaking with Stephanie Kelton, who is a professor of economics and public policy at Storybrooke University in New York. She served as chief economist on the U.S. Senate Budget Committee in 2015 and then became an economic advisor to the Bernie Sanders 2016 presidential campaign. She's the author of The State, The Market, and The Euro, and her forthcoming book is The Deficit Myth. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the record of retiring Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy.
Give me some more. Don't ask.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Lisa Graves, the co-director of Documented, a watchdog group that investigates how corporations manipulate public policy, harming our environment, communities, and democracy. She has served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, as Chief Counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as a Deputy Chief for the U.S. Courts. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lisa Graves.
Thanks, Ian. It's good to hear your voice.
Well, thank you, Lisa. And yesterday was quite a tectonic day in terms of our judiciary and how it's going to be shaped in the future. There's a great deal of pessimism now about the next Supreme Court justice that Donald Trump will appoint, and that will create a 6-3 conservative majority as opposed to the 5-4 split we have now. It's not inconceivable that the 85-year-old Ruth Bader Ginsburg might retire as well on Trump's watch. And then you would have a 7-2 conservative split. So is there any light at the end of this tunnel?
You know, I'm reminded that one of my friends said there's a light at the end of the tunnel and it's a train. It certainly feels that way right now. But I think that we're in the midst of a longer battle for the future of our country. And while it's certainly a crisis, I think it's a constitutional crisis in many ways for Kennedy to have announced his retirement while Trump is in the midst of a criminal investigation with a court that's divided 5-4 in a way that Trump could be appointing the deciding vote on whether he has to comply with subpoenas, whether he could be subject to impeachment, whether his men or henchmen could be held criminally accountable for crimes that are being investigated right now if they're proven. I think that's wholly inappropriate and inconsistent with the very nature of the rule of law that he would be allowed by any party, by any other elected officials in Congress to have such power to make a decisive appointment while he and his administration are embroiled in a very serious criminal matter that goes to the heart of really the sovereignty of America and the integrity of our democracy, our elections from foreign influence and from potential RICO-type activity involving the president's advisors who may have been working with Russia in terms of trying to distort the election. There's certainly ample evidence that Russia wanted to distort the election. There's certainly ample evidence that Russia was reaching out to numerous components of the Trump team to try to help them. So I think that I don't know if there's a light at the end of the tunnel, but I think that more and more Americans are waking up to this problem that we're seeing in terms of the functioning of our democracy. And I think in the coming months, they're going to hear a lot more about why it's completely inappropriate for Trump to be allowed to choose a tie-breaking vote on this court at this time when these criminal investigations are, which are of paramount importance, are ongoing.
Well, the investigations aren't just into his aides, they're into the president himself. And given the president's history of hanging out with gangsters and mobsters and kleptocrats and his affection for tyrants and kleptocrats and the fact that he's going to meet with Putin after meeting with NATO, which he's derided, the NATO leaders are just, they're concerned about Putin, and Trump is rewarding him as he did with Kim Jong-un and got nothing in return. So this is an extraordinary situation. So without being too hyperbolic, the president could be a criminal and he also could be a traitor.
I don't disagree with you. In fact, I think that these are vitally important matters for our criminal justice system to be investigating, both at the federal level and in some instances at the state level. We've never faced a situation like this where a president has shown such affinity toward dictators, certainly not in the modern era of America. And I don't think we've ever had a situation in which there's been such a cloud over an election involving the interference of a foreign power in our elections here in the United States. where a president has been cozied up with that same foreign power who attempted, if not successfully, in multiple ways, to install Trump as the president of the United States. I think that that's not hyperbole. I think that this is the real situation that we face, and many people don't want to believe that or don't want to hear about it. But I think it has to be said. These are of matters of vital importance. They go to the heart of our sovereignty as a nation. And now with the Supreme Court at stake, we're at risk of having the man who is at the center of these investigations, serious investigations by people who have tremendous experience examining criminal conduct and potential criminal conduct. There's no way he should be allowed to appoint someone who could be the deciding vote in his own fate and the fate of our in the integrity of our elections and our democracy until these matters are resolved.
So I spoke yesterday, Lisa, with a law professor who served a clerked for Justice Kennedy, and I asked her about him and how to describe him. She said, well, he's very idealistic, at which point I said, well, maybe he's a little naive, though. I mean, he issued the majority opinion in Citizens United, which has completely transformed our already money-driven politics into completely corrupt money-driven politics with no transparency whatsoever. And there's no question that Citizens United favored the Republicans, as is all of the decisions that just came down in the last few days, all of which Justice Kennedy joined the majority on, all of those also undercutting the Democrats who have already been defunded by the Citizens United. Now they're going to get defunded by public employees unions being eviscerated, and the Voting Rights Act was further eviscerated after Justice Roberts, when he got rid of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, assured us that everything else would still work. And, of course, Kennedy assured us with Citizens United that there will be transparency and accountability and disclosure. Well, nothing of the sort. So are we really giving this guy too much of a break? I mean, you know, obviously he showed humanity and a conscience on same-sex marriage and on abortion rights and on affirmative action. But on everything else, he seems to be furthering what appears to be an extremely partisan agenda of this Republican-dominated Supreme Court to essentially perpetuate Republican power into the future, regardless of demographic change, and essentially enabling a kind of corporatocracy along with a plutocracy.
Well, there's a couple of things I would say in response to that. One is actually in the way of an aside, which is I didn't realize until today that Justice Kennedy's son was great friends with Donald Trump's son, Donald Trump Jr., and that they were friends and allies, in essence, in the real estate market in New York. And one of the first people to sort of boast about Kennedy's retirement yesterday was Donald Trump Jr. About how, quote, lit things are now that Kennedy has finally retired. So I think that there are, you know, it's an interesting sort of small world, I suppose, in some ways. One of his other sons works with Peter Thiel, who's been a backer of Trump. You know, leaving aside the family, Justice Kennedy's family and those ties, I think that one of the things that bears underscoring is that in some ways this circumstance is one where we've been sort of trained by our environment, in the sense that the fact that Justice Kennedy on rare occasions would dissent from the corporate majority that dominates that court on a very small number of cases, significant cases, but a very teeny tiny portion of the court's docket, you know, it causes us to some of us to lament him stepping away, because he did help the court move forward on recognizing discrimination against gay, lesbian, bisexual people in this country, and that's no small thing. But that really is one of the only good and just cases in close cases in which he's been on the right side of history. The bulk of his decisions, the vast majority of decisions in close cases, have been on the wrong side of history. He was in the majority in Bush v. Gore, which, you know, is a decision of naked political power by the U.S. Supreme Court to stop the recount in Florida in 2000, and it basically effectively install George W. Bush as president, even though he had not won a majority of the actual votes cast, and to decisively, effectively give the Florida Electoral College votes to George W. Bush. That's Kennedy. As you point out, Kennedy was also the one who not only joined in the decision in Citizens United, but wrote it, a decision that is one of the most reviled and righteously reviled decisions in modern American history, legal history. It's the decision that has utterly distorted U.S. elections since it was issued in 2010, which has flooded our elections with all sorts of dark money, money which outpaces the disclosed spending by candidates, by these secretive outside groups running ads, acting like they're a PAC but not following the rules of PACs, just because they don't say the magic words of voting for or against a candidate. They have been unleashed by Kennedy to distort the electoral process entirely, and have the effect of minimizing the power of really one person, one vote, because the money that's being injected by the Koch brothers and others is outpacing the money any ordinary American can spend to support a campaign or a candidate that they like, and to do so with disclosure, unlike people like the Kochs through their dark money operations that have been basically legalized through this aggressive reinterpretation of our First Amendment to deny Congress, and by denying Congress, denying the people of this country the power to regulate our own elections by requiring disclosures and limits on the corrupting influence of money by people like the Koch brothers. And so he's not a hero. He's really only rarely been a hero in his life. And he certainly received applause for that rare moment of being a hero in the cases involving gay rights. But other than that, he's been soundly on the wrong side of history, and he has authored a decision that is will someday be repealed and repudiated as completely contrary to the First Amendment, as advancing an extreme corporate agenda that is unjust and inconsistent with our Constitution and our history, and as someone who perhaps naively did so, but deliberately did so in issuing the deplorable decision, and I don't use that word lightly, the despicable decision of Citizens United.
And, of course, the First Amendment is at play there in the sense that Buckley v. Vallejo opened the door and Citizens United opened the floodgates in the idea that money is speech. And Justice Kagan talked about the weaponization of the First Amendment by these conservatives in all of these recent rulings, where they've used the First Amendment as a kind of window dressing for basically rulings that favor corporations and plutocrats. And at the end of the day, the real questions about these justices, whether they're liberal or conservative, should be pretty clear that the conservative majority, now to be even a greater majority, perhaps even a supermajority, always favor the powerful over the powerless, the rich over the poor, the employer over the employee, the corporation over the union, and so forth. That is just a fact. So something happened between, if you go back to the 1970s and think about William O. Douglas and Thurgood Marshall, my God, what happened? What happened to the liberals in this country? Did they lose heart?
I mean, well, no, you know, it's actually, you know, in the modern era, and I would say that's, you know, from sort of the New Deal forward, if you take the modernization of the economy and our society, you know, there's actually been only a very brief period in which there has been what could be described as a progressive majority on the court, and that was actually a majority of Republican appointees that was included Earl Warren, the former Republican governor of California, who for a brief period from Brown v. Board until the Nixon administration, the court actually gave and attempted to give full meaning to our constitutional rights, the right to counsel, due process rights, the rights in the Ninth Amendment and in the Constitution overall to have bodily integrity and privacy. The idea that our electoral system is supposed to be one person, one vote. Those decisions, those landmark decisions, Gideon v. Wainwright and Baker versus Carr and so many others, not the least of which is certainly Brown v. Board of Education. That was a very, very brief window in American history in which the courts actually fulfilled what I believe to be their greatest role, which is to protect the rights of individuals against the powerful, against corporations and the powers of the government to intrude. But the Republicans, changed over that period dramatically with Nixon forward, and starting with Nixon, but then going deeper with Reagan, they really made a determination to dramatically change the court by having litmus tests and putting hard right people on the court. I don't call them conservatives. I don't think of them as conservative at all. They don't conserve. They're not interested in precedent. They're interested in overturning precedent and returning to that sort of gilded age of corporate power, the Lochner era. But the Republicans have put a lot of time, and the Coates have invested in that effort as well, to try to move the courts to basically defend corporate interests, to advance corporate interests to the detriment of the interests of the people in our democracy, in which people are supposed to be sovereigns, not corporations that are not people, and corporations that are created by statute having superior rights to ordinary individuals, as we saw with the Hobby Lobby case. So I think that the trend we've actually been living under for since the 70s has been a trend toward a more right-wing court. And that Buckley versus Valeo decision wasn't just issued by a Republican, right-wing Republican-dominated court, but by a man who was the former lobbyist, or pardon me, the former lawyer for the tobacco industry, Justice Powell. He's the person who wrote the Powell memo are articulating how corporations should play a greater role in American democracy and law. His memo, interestingly enough, was said to not go far enough by Charles Koch back in the 1970s. That corporations need to play a greater role, and so this is the challenge we've been facing.
Well, Lisa Graves, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Lisa Graves, who's the co-director of Documented, a watchdog group that investigates how corporations manipulate public policy, harming our environment, communities, and democracy. She has served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, as Chief Counsel for Nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as Deputy Chief for the U.S. Courts. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Alejandra Larriva-Latt. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.